I am with Dr. Nick Furrell at Royal Holloway University of London and Dr. Lucia Garrido at Brunel, and we are at the Pig's Ear in Richmond. I'm having a... What are you drinking, Nick?
Orange IPA.
Oh, so am I. And Lucia?
I think it's Liberty Pilsner.
So now that we have that out of the way, we're here to talk about the paper that was recently published in the Journal of Neuroscience, and you're both co-authors on the paper. Can one of you read the title?
Effective Connectivity from Early Visual Cortex to Posterior Occipitotemporal Face Areas Supports Face Selectivity and Predicts Developmental Prosopagnosia.
Isn't there some sort of character count on titles?
It's below it, believe it or not.
No. All right. Wow. Okay, so I guess we're going to have to really unpack this. Well, first, congratulations on the paper publication. Cheers.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Faces are obviously really important to humans, so we need to be able to recognize if you're friend or foe and recognize emotions, but the abilities aren't the same across individuals. Could you give me a bit of background? So what is prosopagnosia?
Well, like you said, people differ in their abilities to recognize faces. There's certain group of people who don't appear to have any neurological disorders or don't appear to be unhealthy in any way, but who somehow have failed to develop face recognition abilities that other people commonly have.
And they complain that they have problems recognizing the faces of their relatives, of their friends. They have problems in their daily lives that they can't recognize faces in the same way as most of us do.
Even people they know really well, they can't recognize
yes.
their faces. So do they have a hard time then recognizing whether they're mad at them or not, for example? Or is that in the voice? Or there are enough cues?
Most people with prosopagnosia, they can't even recognize emotion expression from the face pretty well. Not all of them, but most of them can actually do that.
Oh.
They do use other cues, like from the voice as well. But expressions, they can usually read that pretty well compared to recognizing the identity from the face.
So how common is it?
So about 2.5% of the population.
You're born with it, so it's developmental. But it is in your paper, but it can happen with disease or an accident or something, or no, less common.
It can happen after brain damage. That's called acquired prosopagnosia. But the developmental prosopagnosia is cases who have always experienced these problems. And so we think they are present probably from birth because it seems to run in families. So people in the same family have these problems recognizing faces.
They have
commonly.
No idea what they all look like.
Yeah. So we've done some research with a family who use name tags in their family
reunions.
They do!
Oh, that's so sweet! I just have such a bad memory, I would need to do that anyway. Thank you for the background on that. What was your research question for this paper?
This paper goes a little bit with another paper that we were going to try to talk about today a little bit as well.
Sneaky.
Because both of them try to get at whether the connectivity between different brain areas is what gives rise to different abilities in face perception.
So there is a brain area that's really well known for being responsible for being able to recognize faces. What's that brain area?
Fusiform face area is the most well known.
Yeah, so that's part of what you're interested in, right? Yes.
Yeah.
It's involved here, yeah.
It is, okay. So will you tell me a little bit more about the areas that are involved in prosopagnosia or just general face recognition?
Well,
is that too big of a question? The whole thing?
We think that the approach that we were trying to take with both of these papers was to conceive the fusiform face area as one node in a bigger network of areas, and that it was actually the fusiform face area's inability to talk to these other brain areas that actually leads to problems that these people have.
So where was the other paper published?
Neuropsychologia.
Your research question was really looking at connectivity from the fusiform gyrus to the other areas in the brain. Would it be a problem with connectivity?
Yes.
In people with developmental prosopagnosia.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So
we also found that in previous papers that these areas respond less to faces. So these areas, very robustly, the fusiform face area shows a higher response to faces than to other types of stimuli. And anyone you put in the scanner, it always shows these responses. And in prosopagnosics, what we found is that there just seems to be reduced selectivity. So they don't show such a big difference between faces and other things in these face selective areas. So this was the initial finding, and now we wanted to know, but how do they connect to the rest of the brain?
So how did you do that?
Well, in one paper, the one in Neuropsychologia, we actually looked at the physical wiring between the brain areas, how well they're physically connected with each other.
So a neuroanatomical study.
Yeah, this was diffusion tensor imaging. So it actually lets you know how many fibers or how much fiber connection there is between the different brain areas. So it's a structural connectivity. It's really the amount of hardware or wiring that connects the areas.
And what did you find?
Found that in just the area right around the fusiform face area, there was less of this white matter or wiring in developmental prosopagnosics than in other more typical individuals.
And these are adults, all adults.
These are all adults. Okay.
Yeah. But in an official account of prosopagnosia, there was a paper in 2008 that has been quite influential that had shown that these people had these problems in structural connections from these posteriors of the brain to the rest of the brain. And their, like, these major white matter tracts, these major pathways in the brain were, like, reduced in prosopagnosia.
So not just to the fusiform gyrus.
Yeah. But we actually don't find that.
And you don't? Oh, good. That's a little concerning.
Yeah, it's kind of like we think that maybe that would result in lots of other deficits.
Yeah.
But in this group that we tested, we didn't find that. We found that these differences were more localized to these regions that are known to respond to faces, not just these major pathways in the brain that are dysfunctional.
When was that published? 2015?
It was recently, November.
It? Oh, we're very recent. Well, yeah. Congratulations on that one, too.
Thank you.
Cheers. This paper in the Journal of Neuroscience, tell me a bit about it.
Oh, well, this was really the work of my master's student, Michael Loza, first author on the paper. So in this one, we got at connectivity differently. This is more of it's called effective connectivity. Now we're looking at brain activity as measured by functional magnetic resonance imaging.
Right.
And we can look at how activity in one area actually influences activity in other brain areas. So we can look at connectivity that way. How much do the activity in the different areas actually influence each other directly? So you can look at the effect of one area on another.
I see.
Basically.
So you do that. So they're in a scanner, the participants,
yeah,
with or without developmental prosopagnosia.
Yeah.
And then what sort of tasks do they do while in the scanner? So they're looking at something, faces and objects.
Yeah.
Faces and cars, I think it was.
Faces,
right?
And cars, yeah.
Right. Was there anything else that they did, or they simply passively looked at the faces or cars? Were they responding in any way?
Well, it wasn't an exciting task.
There's nothing wrong with looking at faces and cars. And people read those types of magazines all day long.
Yeah. They pressed the button every time they saw the fixation point change color.
Oh.
That just keeps them looking at the center of the screen and hopefully awake.
Right. All right. So what did you find?
We found that there's a hierarchy. Well, this is already known, but there's kind of a hierarchy in the visual system. So you have some areas that respond to really low-level elementary stuff, like lines and edges and things like that, that we know exactly where that is. It's called early visual cortex in the back of your head. And then that early visual cortex projects. It has connections with more areas that process more complicated stimuli. And the FFA, the fusiform face area, is one of these areas that visual cortex projects to or sends connections to. It's this connection in between early visual cortex and FFA that seems to be compromised in the developmental prosopagnosics. So FFA is just not affected by early visual cortex as much as it is in other more typical individuals.
That's interesting. So what's the business with the occipitotemporal face areas?
That's just a general description for all these areas that respond to faces. So not only the fusiform face area, but there's also the occipital face area that is a more lateral
brain,
the superior temporal sulcus that is another area that is also face selective that is in a superior temporal sulcus.
It's a big network.
Now I know. That's from the primary visual area to the rest of the face areas.
Yes.
That's the
yes.
connections that that you found. You developed the first model of face selectivity and compared it to a bunch of other models, but found one model was better than the other models.
That's kind of a finding that's good for typical face recognition. Like Lucia was saying earlier, these areas are kind of special because they respond more to faces than other objects like cars. And so part of what we wanted to do was see how that response bias towards faces comes about.
Right.
And why it is that they like to respond so much towards faces. And is there a network explanation behind all of that? And it seems that it's actually early visual cortex that's driving the responses to faces up in these areas, but not driving up so much the response to other things.
Right.
So it's these very connections that create face selectivity between early visual cortex and the face areas that are also compromised in developmental prosopagnosia.
What is your next step then?
That's a complicated
question. There's a lot of next steps.
We want more subjects.
More subjects.
Yeah,
how do you get your subjects then?
This was all done in 2008, 2009, right?
Yeah,
2007,
yeah.
2008, 2009, that we tested all these people when we were both at UCL. It's actually, London is a really good place because there are so many people that we had a great number of participants. But then we moved on to other jobs and now we're back in London. But some of these people are no longer interested in research, we're now trying to find other ways in which we could get
participants. So you defined this 2.5% of the population to come in and do your experiment.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. And then I was asking Lucia how people know. So is there a diagnosis of this? Is it even a diagnosable thing? Or how do you know that you have prosopagnosia?
The way that we get participants, we collaborate with Brad Duchesne, who's my PhD supervisor, and he has this website called faceblind.org, in which people who have read about prosopagnosia or heard something in the news go and talk about their experiences, and then we contact these people back and ask if they want to come to the lab to be tested. So when they report that they have significant problems in their lives.
So they've already recognized that. Is it super obvious to them that they've got a problem recognizing faces, or is that a surprise to them?
In many cases, it seems like it's only when they hear or read something about it that they realize, other people are not good at this. Many times they think others are just as bad as they are.
Right.
Or they realize they have a problem in early adulthood when they go to an environment in which they need to recognize lots of new people, going to the army, going to the university, and they suddenly need to recognize lots of people and they can't do it. And it's usually young adults when they realize this. And we hear from people from this website, and then we invite them to the lab and we ask them to do a number of tests. And only if they perform badly in those tests compared to the normal population, then we continue testing them.
For a lot of money? Do they get paid? No,
get paid. Like the people who... They are really interested in research. They are really interested in learning more about themselves and learning what's going on. When we're scanning them, most of them were really keen to be scanned. I think then we really tire them because we scan them a lot. We test them a lot.
Well, I hope they know what you found. And you found really interesting, novel things. And I think it's going to be really good to move understanding forward. When I talk about my work with eyewitness identification, people ask me, well, what about people with prosopagnosia? And they would be horrible eyewitnesses, right? Trying to pick a person out of a lineup would be to impossible, right?
But then
only had the face to go on.
So there is an eyewitness, and they're shown a lineup in the police station, and they pick a person, but they say with very low confidence, because they'll, for the most part, know that they're horrible at recognizing faces. Yeah. Will they be likely to, or they...
Are they forced to pick a person, or can they just say, I don't know?
They could say, I don't know. But if they do pick a person, they would say, I don't
know. They'd be less likely to be
They would have low confidence.
But it's an empirical question.
They don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you again for having a drink with me and talking about your research.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers to the paper.
Cheers.